यादेवी स्तुयेदित्यं पिबते वेदपारगैः सामेव सद्जिह्वाग्रे ब्रह्मरूपा सरस्वती। गुड मॉर्निंग। सो टुडेज टॉपिक एज यू नो इज द कंसेप्ट ऑफ मदर वर्शिप। इट इज अ वेरी वेरी यूनिक टॉपिक एंड इट्स यूनिकनेस becomes all the more clear when we peep into the history of the concept of Godhead. When Max Müller published the Rigveda in the middle of 19th century, he wrote a long introduction which remains a classic introduction to the very evolution of the concept of Godhead. He was trying to explain the gradual evolution of the human quest for the divine and the transcendental. So, based on his own understanding of the most ancient spiritual document, that almost belongs to 6th millennium BC, he said there are 5 stages in the evolution of human quest for the transcendental. And he named pantheism, panentheism, polytheism, monotheism, and monism. These are the 5 stages. The first stage in human quest for the divine is pantheism, where you equate this grandeur, beauty, and charm, and sublimity of nature to God. That's how in ancient times man looked at grandeur and beauty of nature. So he deified the universe and world and attributed a sanctity and divinity to everything, to every phenomenon in nature. You find a spark of this influence in the writings of Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, the transcendentalists of American 19th century, and maybe in the history of English literature you find this very, very strong echoes in the works of Shelley, Keats, and Wordsworth, the 3 important Victorian poets of UK in 19th century. Now, this is the first stage in the human concept of the divine. The second stage is more subtle, where you experience the presence of the divine in everything, going beyond equating nature with God. You experience the presence of divine reality within everything. The third stage is the concept of a divine presence in the regulation of natural phenomena. See, rivers, waters, mountains, seas, clouds, all these are deified. So in Rigveda, Indra, Mitra, Varuna, Agni, all these, you know, fire, air, water, clouds, skies, everything. In fact, in modern times, that's what we need. We should go back to some sort of pantheism and some sort of polytheism, especially when we are very proud of polluting nature, exploiting Mother Nature to the maximum extent possible. So, you know, one important synonym for nature, for Earth, is the all-forgiving Mother. So even Dhatri, Dharani, Vasundhara, some of the terms used, synonyms in Sanskrit language, used for calling nature, Earth, is the all-forgiving Mother. Because there is no one who forgives everything. Father may forgive, but Father may also expect you to score high marks in the university. That's what he's hoping for, with all justification. That's an expression of love. But Mother can love you even if you score 0 marks in the examinations, which Father may not be able to do. That's what we are coming to in this subject today. So the third stage is polytheism. The fourth stage is monotheism, where you conceive of one supreme deity, God, who presides over all other deities, all the entire pantheon of the divine. The fifth stage is Advaita, non-dualism, Vedanta, which conceives of the divine, conceives the divine as present in everything and present everywhere, where you equate whatever you do in this world as an act of worship. Every word becomes a sacred mantra, a sacred recitation of a sacred word. Every thought becomes a meditation. Whole life becomes spiritual. That is spiritualization of the secular, the secular and spiritual merging together. That's the highest state. But the first state is pantheism. Now, where does mother worship stand in this evolution? That's what I'm coming to. Now, when you talk about monotheism, which conceives of one supreme Godhead, and strictly speaking, a male Godhead, mind you, that's very important, especially in Abrahamic religions. Well, if you go to Greek mystery religions, you find many wonderful examples of feminine archetypes, feminine divine archetypes. You find in the pre-Christian European religious traditions many great feminine archetypes, divine archetypes you find, equivalent to some sort of mother worship. But it is very profusely found in the pre-Christian Greek mystery religions. In Hinduism, it takes a unique form. It is the highest conceivable idea of Godhead, the mother. Because the uniqueness and the beauty and intimacy of the relationship between mother and her children makes that concept the most humane and the most intimate. So I can just quote from a convocation address used to be given to students who left their Vedic hermitages, the Vedic schools, after 12 years of education in the Vedas. It is found in the Yajurveda that belongs nearly 4000 BC, according to modern Indologists. The convocation is this: Vedam anuchi acharya andevasinam anushasti satyam vada dharmam chara satyana pramadidavyam dharmana pramadidavyam. These are all wonderful statements. I wish we could be included in modern convocation addresses, where children are taught to become morons, machines, or madmen because of overemphasis on machines and technology. You find here, after finishing education, a youngster, a young man or young woman is going back to his or her home to start playing the responsible role of a husband, wife, mother or father. So there are two types of instructions here. You should speak the truth, you should not deviate from truth, you should practice dharma, means righteousness, and you should never deviate from the path of righteousness. The second paragraph is very relevant in our context here. Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, Aditi Devo Bhava. Four instructions, which, you know, you find the teacher is not asking the student to go to temple or a church or a synagogue and pray every day. That's very simple, you know. The easiest thing to do is to go to a temple or a church every day and forget and end religious life then and there at that point. But it's much more difficult to practice religion outside the temple, outside the church, outside the book, outside the rituals. So this teacher is not asking the student to go to the temple every day. He says, let your mother be as adorable, as respectable as God himself. Let your father, that's first instruction is Matru Deva Bhava, not father. So let your mother be as respectable, as honorable to you as God himself. So the sanctity, the sacredness, the spiritual element in human relationship, which elevates family and institutional marriage to a higher spiritual pedestal. One Vedic mantra from Rigveda again, the 10th mandala, which in traditional Hindu marriage rituals, they have to recite is Grinhamite Saubhagatvaya Hasta, means where the married life and husband and wife is equated to a pilgrimage. You are sharing a great, grand spiritual adventure in life. It's a pilgrimage, not an adventure rather. It's a pilgrimage. So the sanctity, the sacredness, the spiritual dimension of family relations, where a mother's responsibility is not just to look after the child till 17th year, and to let the child go away from the home. The son's responsibility ends only when he lights the fire to mother's dead body. That's lighting, you know, that is the funeral in ancient India. They didn't bury the body, they burnt the body. So, in fact, the son's or daughter's responsibility ends only when he practices what is called ritual antiesti, the last ritual, where with prayers to God so that this mother's soul remain in eternal peace, that's the end of human relationship. And the idea of three generations of family members staying together on the strength of the divinity of motherhood, the divinity and the sacredness and sanctity of the relationship between mother and children, that was part of the ancient Vedic heritage. This is a funny story, which has something very unpleasant about it, but it has a lot of punch in it, so I want to narrate to you. So it so happened in modern times that parents, the little child, small little babe child, found that his parents were not treating their parents very well. So the father used to use a broken pot or plate to feed his father. So the little child, that means the grandchild of the family, was one day going around home looking for something. His father asked him, "What are you looking for?" "I am looking for a broken pot so that I can feed you when you get old." And that put a lot of wisdom, that brought the father to an awareness of his responsibility to his parents. So that's a story, in fact, which is narrated frequently. It's coming from an ancient book called Katha Sari Sagara, Ocean of Ancient Fables in Sanskrit language. So what I mean to say is, the idea of sacredness and sanctity attached to the relationship between mother to mother. Now, you find there are many verses in ancient Sanskrit language which elevates the status of mother in the family, and that motherhood is transferred to the concept of God. So if the relationship between a mother and child is the most intimate, the most spontaneous, and the most sacred, and the most unbreakable, even physically, then that idea is elevated to a spiritual dimension. So if you can think of God as a mother, as our mother, then there cannot be a more humane and more intimate idea of Godhead. That's the origin of the concept of God as mother. As I mentioned earlier, you may have, of course, heard of the Durga Puja. It's a festival associated with Diwali in some places, where God, the mother, is worshipped. The name of mother frequently used is Sharada. And this often is spelled as S-A-R-A-D-A, one way of spelling. The other spelling is S-H-A-R-A-D-A. So, Sarada and Sharada, these are two words. Now, the description of Sarada is in Sanskrit, Saram Didadidi Sarada. The one, the mother who gives you the ultimate spiritual wisdom, comforts, science, technology, education, everything, and also the ability to handle those skills properly. That is wisdom. So the later contribution is much more important, equally important. So that frequently it is going to bhukti mukti pradayini. You conceive God as a mother who feeds you, who gives you food, gives you education, but also will give you the wisdom to handle the fruits of this education. Education can be used for good or bad purposes, as we are witnessing in this 21st century in so many diverse ways. So without that higher wisdom, the transcendental vision, education and all the skills that you get from science and technology can be a source of trouble, can be liabilities. That is one meaning. The other meaning is Sharadkale Pujidayati Sharada. God, the Divine Mother, whom you worship in autumnal season. So autumn season is associated with prosperity, good weather, and also because of the climatical change in Indian subcontinent, it could also can cause epidemics. So, mother should give prosperity, wealth and wisdom, and also this higher, the ability to see the limitation of material wealth and material comforts. So it is called bhukti and mukti. Bhukti means, let us say in modern times, let us say good job, good education, lot of money in the bank, a wonderful everything going fine. But that's not enough. So, if you can understand the relevance, the importance of acquiring wealth, that is wonderful. That can make you successful in this world. But if you can also understand that this success is necessary, it is absolutely essential, but something more is necessary to make life more meaningful. A higher wisdom that enables us to understand that material success is necessary, but material success can be a problem unless we also try to get higher wisdom, spiritual wisdom, the transcendental wisdom that enables us to understand the limitation, the lopsidedness of material wealth minus the ability to handle that wealth. So this is one unique concept of this mother idea. In fact, one of our lawgivers who lived in Vedic times called Manu, he has a very wonderful statement. He gives you an idea of a graphic description of the importance and sanctity and sacredness of mother in the family. The verse is Ubadhyaya Deshacharya Acharya Tu Shadambida Sagasrena Adhigam Matuku Gauravena Adirichyade. This is the verse. Don't worry about the verse, I should translate and explain. What it means is Ubadhyaya means, let's say, somebody who goes to university gives one lecture on a special subject. He's an invited guest lecturer, guest speaker. So you should respect him, but you should give 10 times as much respect to a professor who is teaching you regularly. And then the lawgiver tells you, what about father? Father is the one who first tells you do's and don'ts. After mother, of course. That's what we are coming to. So the respect to be given to father in the family is 100 times as much as the respect you give to a professor in the university who is teaching you every day. And then, Sahasrenadhikam Adhu Gauravenadhirichide. The respect and the reverence and appreciation that you should give to your mother is 1,000 times as much as the respect that you give to your father. This is an interesting description. Because according to him, a child imbibes, doesn't really learn, imbibes from mother. So much of what we are is the result of the instruction that you get from mother. That's why behind every great man and behind every great woman, there is either a all-forgiving, affectionate mother, or in her absence, an all-forgiving, affectionate wife. The former is much more important. I can give the example of Shankaracharya, who actually organized and founded 10 monastic orders in the 8th century, one of which Vivekananda reactivated and renovated, gave a new dimension in 19th century, to which we all belong. All the honors modern. When Shankaracharya was born in 8th century, there were so many monastics, but they were not formed into regular monastic orders. So when Buddha became a monk, he was a monk, but later he founded Buddhism as a separate tradition. So the same tradition, the tradition goes back to pre-Buddhist times, but Shankaracharya founded 10 monastic orders. And maybe the most archetypal illustration of the grandeur and sacredness of the mother ideal in family, elevated the mother ideal in spiritual life, could be found in his life, in Shankaracharya's life. He was a boy less than 7 years when he left his home to become a monk and walked 1,200 miles to meet his teacher. He had already studied, he had completed all philosophical studies, Sanskrit, everything. But he wanted to become the student of a great monk. So he walked 1,200 miles and going to Bhagavapada, that's his name, and became his disciple and wrote the most magnificent Sanskrit philosophical works in Sanskrit language, the most beautiful devotional poetry in Sanskrit, 10 monastic orders, held hundreds of debates, installed scores of temples, founded 4 ancient monasteries, one of which still our main center to which we are attached, and walked all over Indian subcontinent of that time, which included today's Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, 4 times, and passed away when he was just 32 years. This is the man we are talking about. Sister Nivedita tells us that he was a combination of Ignatius Loyola, who wanted only just one monastic order, the Jesuit order, Aristotle, Kant, Hegel, Socrates, Abelard, all. Anyway, I'm not going to that. There's something about his life. His mother was very unhappy when he decided to become a monk. His father had passed away a few years earlier, so his mother was very, very sad. So mother insisted that he should undertake one vow. Whenever she felt the need of her son to be near her, he should appear there. And when Shankaracharya was about 16 years, he was maybe 2,000 miles away from his home, wandering, teaching and spreading and preaching. He felt his mother was calling, and he came back to his home and consoled the mother. That tradition was continued by the founder of our Vedanta society, in fact, Swami Vivekananda, who continued looking after his mother, and who said that this mother was the one, mother's sacrifice, mother's affection, was his inspiration that made him what he became eventually. So, this is the place, this is the importance of mother ideal. Now, this mother ideal is conceived to be the supreme divine concept in Hindu tradition. So you find Saraswati, for example. Saraswati is the ideal of learning and wisdom. Lakshmi is the ideal of prosperity. And Kali is the ideal who destroys all wrong, evil tendencies in our mind, making our mind pure. That's why the most common way of worshipping this divine feminine archetype in traditional Indian culture, Hindu culture, is to meditate in the morning and evening on this divine reality, which is considered to be the anthropomorphic, or rather the human dimension of divine energy, all-pervading divine energy present everywhere. So this mother is invoked to be present in your heart as metta, as the supreme wisdom. So when you meditate on the all-pervading divine energy as a feminine divine archetype, that is all-pervading, and you meditate uttering this Gayatri Mantra, then that divinity begins to manifest in our hearts. After all, what you think that you can become, we can easily find, if in San Francisco, the children admiring and thinking and contemplating on the players of 49ers, eventually they become the 7 feet fellows playing football. So whatever we idolize, that we become, even on a physical level, you find this happening. People admiring footballers, cricketers, sportsmen, they eventually, at least in very many cases, at least they become amateur sportsmen. So if we can conceive of the omnipresent divine energy as the all-forgiving divine mother, and you pray to that mother to be present in your heart, then that is the highest prayer one can think of. Here, so I can just, well, maybe it's, I can just recite a few of those verses, maybe interesting. So here, in the morning, the spiritual seeker prays to Mother, O Gayatri. Gayatri is a 21-syllable sacred chant. What do you call a mantra? So this is when Ojosi, Sahosi, Belamasi, Brajosi, Devanam, Dhamanamasi, etc. This point. Ojosi, Sahosi, Belamasi, Brajosi, Devanam, Dhamanamasi, etc. Then you find Gayatri Mavahayami, Savitri Mavahayami, Saraswati Mavahayami. So this mother is conceived to be Savitri, Gayatri, Saraswati. So I invoke Gayatri, I invoke Saraswati, I invoke this mother who is the essence of all learning and all wisdom in the morning. So you can find in ancient times, the most and the earliest form of mother worship, conceiving God as the divine feminine archetype is the worship of Gayatri. So Gayatri is the name of a meter in Sanskrit, the most sacred meter. Gayatri also is a name of the divine spiritual energy which is all-pervading, which is omnipresent and also immanent. So in the morning, in ancient times, the ancient Vedic sages used to turn to the east, and looking at the rising sun, used to meditate, chanting this mantra: I invoke into my heart the all-pervading presence of the divine spiritual wisdom. So I mentioned his guy, you know, Saraswati Mavahayami. Now Saraswati is a unique concept in this tradition. Saraswati is the one who helps you to learn, as I mentioned earlier, and also helps you to handle your learning, to be very, very simple. I'm putting in as simple a language as possible. To handle, to make proper use of what we learn, and to avoid making improper use of what we learn, which needs this higher wisdom. So in the ancient tradition, they believe if people should read what you write or listen to what you speak and be benefited by what you speak, you need the blessings of the Saraswati. So that's the idea behind. So you can think of the great classics, spiritual classics, Bible, the Bhagavad Gita, Dhammapada, any tradition, you know, in all traditions, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, in all traditions you find great classical books which have benefited, which has given humanity this spiritual wisdom, which made them better human beings to themselves and good human beings to others. That's also very important. It's not enough that it should give us wisdom. That wisdom should be for the good of others. Frequently, you know, our wisdom may be good for us, but it would be a big problem for the rest of the world. There have been such traditions, religious traditions even. So here, the idea is the Saraswati, as the all-forgiving divine mother who looks upon the whole creation as her child. Creation doesn't mean human beings alone. Creation includes the animal kingdom, the human world, and also the nature. Because if we pollute the earth, we are doing harm to human beings, no different. There's no doubt about it. So if we can think of God as the divine feminine mother archetype, then we can all live as children of the same mother. So fanaticism can be totally eliminated. If you think of God as a very powerful, some sort of a muscular man sitting above the clouds, who tells you, you believe in me, don't worship others, you read this book, don't read any other book. And if you do all that, you can go to heaven, otherwise you go to hell. Frequently, such gods are big problems for the humanity, in fact. In fact, Vivekananda said, better to be an atheist than this sort of thing. So Swami Vivekananda had a very strong language to use. On the other hand, when you look upon the whole creation as the creation, the child of the all-pervading divine feminine mother, then you can't do harm to any other person. You can't even do harm to an animal or even the external nature. Because you know that by doing harm to another human being or even external nature, we are doing harm to ourselves. We are doing harm to our own spiritual family. So this wisdom is the result of prayer in the morning. So you can find in Ojosi, Sahosi, Belemasi, Brajosi, etc. Oh, mother, your patience, you know, your patience, you are the one who gives us physical capacity. You are the one who helps us to love and look upon the whole creation as one spiritual family. You are the life of lifespan of all. And you are the vanquisher of all that is evil in all of us. Our wrong tendencies, negativity of the mind, wrong ideas, all these will be vanquished by the presence of this all-forgiving mother. So, I invoke Gayatri. So you find Gayatri Mavahayami, Savitri Mahav. See, Gayatri is the name given to this all-pervading divine mother in the morning, and Savitri is the name given in the midday, and Saraswati is the name given in the evening. So these are the ancient times, you know, they have nothing else to do than this sort of worship. You think of 6th millennium BC. So, but at least in today's times, if we can think of these possibilities and keep this ideal somewhere in the remote horizon, that itself will be a great help and blessing to humanity. So that's one idea. Now, there is another prayer which is also very important. This Divine Mother, as the omnipresent spiritual energy, is present in me. And in the evening, you are asking this Divine Mother to go back to the higher mountains. It's a symbolic expression. So you find Uttame Shikare Devi Bhumyam Parvada Murdhani Brahmane Bhyobhanu Jnada Gachadevi Yathasukam. Now, Mother, you have helped me, you have enabled me to live a meaningful life the whole day. Now, Mother, you go back to your higher abode to return tomorrow when I turn to you in a prayerful meditation. So these ideas are part of the Vedic tradition. Now, I have mentioned one important incident in Shankaracharya's life. This great spiritual philosopher, he wrote innumerable poems, very long poems, on the Divine Mother, Saundari Lehari, Ananda Lehari, Devi Aparadakshavavana Stotra, many. And Madhur Panchakam. So Madhur Panchakam is 5 verses. So, in that poem, he tells, you can perhaps break all your bonds with all other members of the family, but you cannot break your bond, your indebtedness to your mother. He wrote a long poem in which he looks upon the Supreme God and Goddess as the Divine Mother. And it is called Chadu Shashti Upajara Puja Stotram. What it means is a long poem in which he explains 64 forms of worshipping the Divine Mother. Chadu Shashti means 64. So Ushasi Magadha Mangala Gayanehi Jadidi Jagrihi 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 Adikrubadra Kadaksha Nirikshanehi Jagadidam Jagadamba Sukhikuru. Amba means mother. So Shankaracharya is addressing the all-pervading, omnipresent divine energy as the feminine archetype, the divine mother. Oh, mother, it's morning, you get up quickly and please accept, please. Adikrubadra Kadaksha Nirikshanehi means you give a glance, just have a glance at the whole creation, the world, with your eyes filled with compassion and mercy, and bless this world. And then please accept from me this flower, this water, you know, this incense sticks, this lamp, which you do puja, you have seen all these prayers. It's a very long poem. And he says, Even if you do not believe in God, still, if one can sit in the early morning, look in whatever direction you want, and think of the divine energy present everywhere, manifesting as the mother of the universe, not just your mother, but mother of the universe. So the personal intimacy of the relationship between a son or a daughter and mother in the family setting is elevated to the personal intimacy and the divine relationship between the whole humanity, the whole creation, and mother, who is conceived to be the creator, the mother of the whole creation. So at the micro level, if you can be an ideal son or a daughter, you can also be an ideal devotee of God as the Divine Mother. So that's why, you know, in the Hindu, in this Shakta tradition is related to mother worship, Devi as the divine feminine, you know. There is this idea, Vidya Samastha Stava Devi Bhedaha Striya Samastha Sagala Jagatsu. All learnings, all skills, all our achievements are considered to be manifestations of the Divine Mother. So that means we may work hard, acquire great learning and skill, but that skill is deified, and you try to attach a spiritual element, a sanctity and sacredness, to whatever skills or learning or talents that we have. Because Vidya Samastha Stava Devi Bheda, it's going to be Durga Saptashati, 700 verses, you find famous book that we chant perhaps, you know, during puja times in cold. So all branches of learning, all skills, all intellectual achievements are so many expressions of this divine feminine archetype, expressing in so many diverse ways, different ways. Then every skill, every learning becomes a blessing, not only to us, but also to others. So that's how a spiritual aspect is attached to language. One of a very famous Swamiji, I won't mention the name, it's not proper, who eventually became the president of the order. He was an international orator and speaker. You know, he became so great, though he didn't have much of a high formal education. He didn't go to the university, in fact. But he became, perhaps after Vivekananda, one of the most reputed scholars and orators in our tradition. As a small boy, he started mixing with children, perhaps, you know, who frequently use undesirable expression, bad words. So one day the child returned home, and in his innocence, maybe 5-year-old child, young boy, used that word. The mother was shocked. The mother didn't beat him. The mother called him to his side and said, "Look here, son, Goddess Saraswati is sitting on your tongue." And that was a great turning point in the life of the little boy. Goddess Saraswati is sitting on your tongue. It is siding on your tongue. So if we can use our language, the words we speak, in a way that we remember that a word is not just a word. A word is an expression of the divine. A word can have an impact, a potency, an influence, a power to refine our mind, to civilize our character, to help us in our spiritual evolution. So every word, every sentence, language itself can be a vehicle for expressing the presence of the divine energy. That was a turning point in his life. That's why in the mantra shastra, in the science of practicing these sacred chants, there are five levels of evolution. At the highest level, you become you identify yourself with the essence of what that mantra, the sacred word, denotes. So it's called para, paschendi, madhyama, vaikari. There are four levels I mentioned. At the highest level is para, means where you meditate, you chant it in total silence, because you become one with, you identify yourself with the essence of the sacred word symbol. At the lowest level, you chant loudly. That's good in faith. The beginning of every kind of spiritual practice is some kind of music. You can shout, but shouting good words. That's good in fact. That's the beginning actually. It's a kindergarten of spiritual life. You're shouting loud chants, loud bhajans, of course, can create problems for the neighbors, but still, actually, there are so many undesirable sound vibrations spread all over the world. So some good desirable sound vibrations you're contributing. In a way, that's one way making some good contribution. A still higher form of chanting sacred mantras, sacred words, is to chant it not so loudly, but rather without making much noise, in a lips moving, but you don't do it very loudly. The third stage is you chant mentally. The fourth stage is you become one with that. That is called para, paschendi, madhyama, vaikari. At the lowest level, very loud. At the highest level, total silence. Where the word terminates in silence. The word, at the beginning there is silence because you don't speak. At the end there is silence because the word, as an experience, when it reaches the level of experience, it terminates in silence. So that is the idea behind. So I was trying to give many of these ideas in general, but the main point, remember, is the symbolism of mother worship. So you find flowers are offered, water is offered, fruits are offered, other offerings are given. All these are, it's not that the image or the photo or anything eats all these things. By offering, we are benefiting ourselves. So that's a very important point to remember. Frequently, people who do not understand the importance of image worship, they criticize it. Every tradition has its own image. If you say you have to turn in one direction and pray, that direction becomes your image. If you have any kind of formal rituals, become a corresponding ideal. So every kind of external worship, with or without photos, symbols, or pictures, whatever it is a prelude to a higher form of internal worship. So first, you invoke the presence of the all-pervading divine energy on the word you are mentally chanting, which becomes your image, it could become pratika or symbol, word symbol, so to speak, or the photo or the image in front of you. You are chanting some sacred chants, word symbols, mantras, invoking the presence of the all-pervading divine energy to be present. Finally, the last stage of this worship, you are praying to that Divine Mother to be present in your heart. So every kind of external prayer is only a means for eventually experiencing the presence of the divine within us. All external forms are steps or means and methods that eventually help us to feel the presence of the divine within our heart. Temple worship is meant to enable us. It is meant to experience the presence of the God outside the temple. External worship is necessary. Kindergarten is necessary. Primary school is necessary. But we should not stop our education in the kindergarten or primary school. In spiritual life also. Books, sacred books, sacred chants, sacred mantras, all these external things are necessary. Because our five senses drag our mind towards external objects all the time. Visual objects, audio objects, smells, sounds, everything. All the external objects are different kinds of distractions. So when we turn our attention, our mind into some symbol in front of us, our ears, our eyes, our sense of touch, sense of smell are withdrawn from the external objects and focused on this sublime image or symbol. It could be a word symbol, a sacred mantra. It could be an external symbol like a photo or image, whatever it is. Eventually, that culminates in the higher experience when we feel the presence of the divine in our own heart. So that is the symbolism of all kinds of worship. That means, as a fact, as a doctrine, as a theory, we know the divine reality is present everywhere. It is all-pervading. But it is only an idea, a concept for us, not an experience. You know, there's a long distance you have to travel from an idea to an experience. So external forms of worship helps us to travel this distance from a concept or an idea to an experience. So once we feel the presence of the divine within us, that's the ultimate goal, and that's a realization of all kinds of divine worship. When we look upon God as the all-pervading mother, the informality, the intimacy, the humanness, the spontaneity, and the naturalness, all these concepts, all these natural feelings, emotions that we have in our relationship with our mother are given a spiritual dimension. That means religion and spirituality becomes humane. Spirituality expresses itself as compassion, understanding, looking upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family, which the whole humanity is the child of the mother, whose child we too are. So this is the uniqueness of the concept of God as the divine mother. So if there are questions, we will discuss during the Q&A, question and answer session. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.